From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Tanya, it is great to have you join me and Robin as our new co-host.
Thank you so much for the warm welcome. It's great to be here. So with that, let's get to today's news. It's been nearly a week since the mass shootings in Texas and Ohio, and there are signs of movement on gun legislation in Washington. This morning, outside the White House, President Trump said he's for, quote, intelligent background checks for firearms purchases.
We're really looking at very meaningful background checks. I think it's going to happen. There's great, great support, but we're looking at very, very meaningful background checks.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says the Senate will look at proposals for gun legislation. McConnell told reporters that President Trump called him about so-called red flag laws that would make it harder for some people with mental illnesses to possess and purchase guns. But McConnell has refused to call the Senate back from recess despite calls for him to do so. We're joined now by NPR political reporter Tim Mak. Hey, Tim.
Hey there.
Well, we've been talking about this for days after the shootings, and I'd love to know from you. The president spoke with reporters this morning on the White House lawn. What direction do you think the president appears to be moving in?
Well, he seems to be leaning in the direction of background checks, right? That he's saying, quote, we need meaningful background checks. He's saying that he would support them if they were done in a, quote unquote, intelligent manner. Now, this is not the default position for a Republican president to be in. The president and his base especially have long featured a lot of Second Amendment supporters, some very stringent and passionate Second Amendment supporters. So it's not the default position for the president or a Republican president to support background checks or support some sort of gun control legislation. But it does seem like that's the direction we're headed in.
And what differences do you think we will be seeing folks talking about? I mean, just as recently as February, we were talking about gun control legislation and background checks as part of that legislation.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that there was a sort of sense that the two back-to-back shootings, these two shootings that happened and caused mass casualties in such a short period of time, had a different impact on public opinion and a lot of lawmakers who are trying to have conversations with their constituents about it. That this sort of legislation, which has been unsuccessful in the past, may have a better chance of being successful in this climate following these shootings.
Yeah, this week, the president also said he talked with the National Rifle Association, and he praised them as great patriots. You've also reported on some of the turmoil within the NRA, but they still have the president's ear, right? How much does this play into what we're going to see moving forward?
I mean, the president said just today that he talked to the head of the NRA, Wayne LaPierre, and he said basically, hey, I've done things for you folks that that the NRA support of him has, quote, paid off because he's nominated and helped confirm two Supreme Court justices that are big supporters of the Second Amendment. So, yes, they do have the president's ear, but the president's kind of pushing back as well, saying, look, I've done this for you. Maybe it's time for you to be, if not supportive of background check legislation, maybe a little bit more neutral. Those were his words today.
Yeah, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, we were talking about those red flag laws. He spoke to a radio station in Kentucky today about a conversation he had with the president. Let's take a listen.
We're going to put together bipartisan discussions and get started so that we are, hopefully by the time we get back, narrowed some of the differences and see what we can actually turn into a law rather than just finger pointing.
Very quickly, with the few seconds that we have, Tim, what do you think McConnell is actually saying with this?
In a lot of ways, he's just trying to keep his powder dry. You notice that in that statement, he doesn't refer to any specific gun control measures or any legislation or proposal that he actually supports. And he's been this way for the last week. He's trying to get lawmakers to come to a deal where 60 senators can support. And so far, that's proven elusive.
Thank you so much. That's NPR political reporter Tim Mak. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks a lot.
Well, to Hong Kong now, where thousands of protesters have begun what they say will be a three-day occupation of the airport. Activists dressed in black are waving banners in the airport's arrivals hall and passing out leaflets to people arriving in Hong Kong. These protests began months ago in response to an extradition bill proposed by Hong Kong's government. but have since shifted to broader demands for more autonomy from mainland China. The BBC's Stephen McDonald joins us from Hong Kong. Stephen, describe what you saw at the airport today.
Well, we were there for several hours, and what started with hundreds soon became thousands as the cavernous arrival hall at Hong Kong International Airport was filled with black-clad pro-democracy activists. They held a sit-in, they were holding up banners, criticising the government and calling for an independent inquiry into the police. They're accusing certain officers, at least, of colluding with triad gangs. And they also say they want genuine universal suffrage. They want to choose who their leader is. They want to choose members of the Legislative Council. And anybody flying into Hong Kong today, they would have picked up their luggage, pushed their trolley through customs and walked out into this sea of sound, chanting, people singing, and they would have been immediately aware that there is a political crisis now in Hong Kong going into its third month with no sign of slowing down.
Now, Hong Kong's leader Carrie Lam warned protesters about the impact these demonstrations are having on the territory's economy. Let's listen.
They did not mind destroying Hong Kong's economy. They have no stake in the society which so many people have helped to build. And that's why they resort to all this violence and obstructions, causing huge damage to the economy and to the daily life of the people.
What has the economic impact of the unrest and the protest been in Hong Kong?
Well, there has to have been some impact. It's hard to measure it, but I've spoken to some small business owners who've felt it, especially if you're relying on tourists to come here, and especially mainland tourists. People might be worried about violence. So, yeah, definitely there has been some impact. However, the surprising thing, I think, is when you talk to small business owners or taxi drivers and the like, the level at which support for the protesters is holding up is also quite remarkable. Mm. You'd be madness to suggest there's been no impact on the economy. There has to have been significant impact. It's just that for many here, there are bigger fish to fry than, I guess, what they think is the short-term economic impact.
Now, yesterday, the U.S. State Department said China was behaving like a thuggish regime after a pro-government newspaper published the personal information of an American diplomat in Hong Kong. China dismissed those comments as gangster logic and has repeatedly accused the U.S. of interfering in Hong Kong. What do you make of that back and forth between the U.S. and China?
Well, it is interesting because until now, the comments of President Trump have been quite praiseworthy of Xi Jinping and his administration's handling of this. The pressure really is ramping up on everybody here, though. For example, Cathay Pacific, people will know that's a right. Hong Kong airline. We've just heard from the central authorities in Beijing that from now on, they need to be given a full list of the crew of every Cathay flight. Any crew member who's been involved in any way supporting the pro-democracy movement will not be able to fly into China or over China, for that matter. And I think it's just a way of, in Australia, we'd say, putting the frighteners through an industry. It means that people will be afraid of participating in the future. They're trying to ramp up pressure from the Beijing end because they feel that the Hong Kong government hasn't been doing enough itself. You can imagine the phone calls from the Politburo Standing Committee to the government here, to Carrie Lam. You know, what are you doing? You've got to arrest more people. And I think the next stage is going to have to be mass arrests. More than a couple of hundred. They're going to have to start arresting thousands of protesters.
Well, and by the way, the protesters, we read, have developed some clever ways to prevent the government from using facial recognition technology to identify them. They've been using laser pointers in the air in an attempt to interfere with police cameras. But let me just ask you finally, Stephen McDonald, what is going to bring this to conclusion, do you think?
Well, this is the big question. And the ominous deadline we're facing is October the 1st. So that's the 70th anniversary of the foundation of the People's Republic of China. Now, there is no way that Xi Jinping's administration wants there to be these violent clashes going on in Hong Kong at the same time as this celebration. So I think if we have many more days like the widespread strike we had on Monday, I think we are going to see some significant escalation. just a small indication to give you how it's been escalating. Before this Monday, the police had fired 1,000 rounds of tear gas from the 9th of June until this Monday. Then on this Monday alone, they fired another 800 rounds.
Wow.
So we used to consider that it would be a long shot for the People's Liberation Army to be called out if these clashes continue and if the Hong Kong authorities can't stop them. I wouldn't be surprised if within 5 weeks we see a very tough response from Beijing.
That's the BBC's Stephen McDonnell in Hong Kong. Stephen, thank you.
Good to talk to you.
And another story we're following today. The British economy has shrunk for the first time since 2012 by 0.2% between April and June. Economists say manufacturers had been stockpiling ahead of the last Brexit date of March 29th. Now they're using those stockpiles. But there's another Brexit date set for October 31st. Many have warned of an economic catastrophe for the UK if it leaves the European Union with no deal.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
There was a lot in the Republican tax bill back in 2017, including something called opportunity zones designed to spur investment in low-income areas. The idea initially got a lot of positive attention from Nipsey Hussle to Cory Booker and beyond. Here's what the president had to say at a rally in Cincinnati last week.
And our tax plan also created nearly 9,000 opportunity zones, hottest thing going.
Noah Buchheyer has been looking into opportunity zones for Bloomberg News. He joins us from Seattle. Hi, Noah.
Hi.
So first of all, just remind us what opportunity zones are.
Opportunity zones are roughly 8,700 census tracts around the country. So in the middle of the city, it might just be a couple of square blocks. If you're talking about a rural area, it could be like a whole county or even bigger. And by definition, they're low-income areas that the federal government asks states to select because the government wants to funnel investment into these areas. And folks who take capital gains that they've earned on investments elsewhere and put some of that money into an opportunity zone can get a suite of benefits for building real estate or starting a business there that could lower their tax bill in the future.
What is that benefit? What are the tax credits that are involved here?
Well, the biggest one is, say you build a new apartment building in an opportunity zone and you hold that investment for a decade. Mm-hmm. If that apartment building goes up in value, you owe no capital gains tax on it.
No matter how much it goes up.
No matter how much it goes up.
Wow.
And there are a couple of other ones in there as well that allow you to lower your tax bill on capital gains that you use to fund that apartment building.
Hmm. So what kind of projects are being built as part of these opportunity zones?
Well, really what we're seeing right now is a lot of real estate. The federal government and the Trump administration would really like this to encourage job creation, so businesses. But to date, what we've seen a lot of are investments in ground-up development in urban areas like Los Angeles and downtown Portland, Oregon, and Brooklyn. And there are some reasons for that in the way that the law is written. You need to keep your investment in one of these zones for a decade, and a building is not going to walk up and move the way that a business mm-hmm. might need to if it grew beyond the zone. But largely we're seeing investments in urban areas. Some might say gentrifying urban areas, but that's really been the majority of it so far.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Portland, Oregon, because did I read that all of downtown Portland, Oregon is considered an opportunity zone?
Yeah, the core central business district and some close-in neighborhoods like the Pearl, which is one of their very tony areas in Portland, were all selected. And there's some reasons for that. I mean, there's a good amount of low-income housing in the core of Portland, Oregon, which allowed those zones to be selected. Policymakers there, I should note that it was the state government, the governor of each state that got to select these zones, basically had to weigh areas that needed the investment but also that were likely to receive it, because there's nothing forcing investors to spread their money evenly across these 8,700 zones. There are definitely ones that look more attractive to investors, and Portland is one of those.
So it seems from what you're saying like it would be pretty easy to take advantage of this part of the tax law and get away with paying no capital gains on an investment that you hold for 10 years in a place that may not need that much investment right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really comes down to what do you mean by take advantage. You know, the folks who are behind this really believe that the fundamental issue is that we have a lot of places in the country that just haven't seen a lot of investment, and they need that, and this is going to help get capital off the sidelines. But as you point out, a lot of these are in areas that probably were going to get investment anyway. And so the question then becomes, is this motivating more capital to go into those areas, or is it really just giving a sweetener to things that would have happened anyway?
Well, and also just giving more tax breaks to very wealthy investors, I would think, in some cases.
Yeah, that's a very important point. I mean, this is something that you can really only claim if you have capital gains. It's not so much an incentive that is geared at wealth creation for low income families. Those may be second order effects. Say if you know a business is started in an opportunity zone and someone gets a job and they're able to grow a nest egg that way. But to get the ball rolling on this, you got to have capital gains.
What is it doing when it comes to gentrification?
Well, I think a lot of that remains to be seen. And one of the real big open questions about this is, where is all this money going? So a lot of folks in the philanthropic community and who work in affordable housing, for instance, have been calling for the federal government to release data on where this investment is happening. As it stands right now, if you want to invest in an opportunity zone, the main requirement is that you follow the rules and then you tell the IRS what you did. There's a form for this. But as the public, we don't really have good data or good information on where the dollars are flowing. Over time, I suspect the government will do some reporting on this so that if the policy needs to be tweaked in any way, we can start looking at what those changes might need to be.
That's Noah Buchheyer, who is a reporter for Bloomberg News, talking with us about opportunity zones. This is part of the president's tax cut package from 2017. Noah, thanks.
Thank you.
And now to the town of Salinas, California, where police are taking an unconventional approach to mend its contentious relationship with the community. This summer, two Salinas Police Department officers are tapping into the rich Mexican culture of the region by donning traditional charro suits and sombreros at the rodeo and other events. Joining us to talk about all of this is Officer Gabriel Carvey. Welcome, Officer Carvey.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Salinas Police Chief Adele Frese. Thank you both for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
I'd like to give listeners some context about the city of Salinas, often called the salad bowl of the world, right? Because there are about 70% of our lettuce comes from there. Nearly 80% of folks in Salinas, California identify as Hispanic or Latino. And about 5 years ago, four Latino men were killed by police in separate incidents. These killings sparked protests and demonstrations there. The officers involved were cleared of wrongdoing, but there's been long-standing tensions with police and the community. So I'd like to start with you, Officer Carvey. This was your idea to wear a sombrero and charro to this summer's rodeo as part of this larger mission to build trust. I'd love to know how you came up with this idea.
So I've been a police officer here in Salinas for about 20 years, and I have had a wonderful career here. And we have a rodeo that happens in the third week of July. Next year, we'll celebrate its 110th anniversary. The Salinas Rodeo uses the term rodeo, and that lends itself to our Hispanic heritage here in this valley. For years and years, as long as I can remember, the police department donned Wrangler jeans and cowboy hats and boots for that week, and it was the authorized uniform. And it just dawned on me in speaking with the chief how interesting that was, that we were celebrating the history of the American cowboy at our Salinas Rodeo. And that's where the idea of the charro came.
And tell us a little bit about the significance of the charro, specifically for Mexican Americans.
So the charro is the official sport of Mexico, and it's kind of an ode to those old school values of honor, respect, courage, honesty, and we just want to draw out those same values in our community.
What's been the reaction of individuals when they see you walk up, you have on this charro suit? Tell us a story. How are they reacting to you?
The support has been absolutely incredible. The first time I wore it, I was very a little bit insecure about what the reaction was going to be. But as soon as I donned the suit, the reception was just absolutely incredible. People lining up to take pictures, shaking hands.
I heard there were even tears.
Absolutely. And for them to see that we are recognizing that and honoring that and wanting to be part of that culture of saying, we're all Americans, we all come from someplace else, and if we can key on the shared values, we all are, as a community, much stronger.
Chief, I want to talk to you a little bit about this larger effort to build trust in your community. Wearing this charro suit is one of the things that you all are doing, but you're really wanting to build a relationship that, in many ways, has been fractured. To be candid, there was the Department of Justice found that the police department lacked transparency and community engagement. Tell us a little bit more about some of the other things you're doing.
Yes, we were said to have a bifurcation here in our community and that we needed to work hard to build relationships with the community members. So we dedicated a police recruiter to answer questions about the hiring process. That's something we had not done previously, and we wanted to increase our diversity and hire more women, and we're going to continue to find new ways to hear their concerns so we can help them enjoy their life here and live in safety.
I hear that you all are planning to wear the charro suit again in September for Mexican Independence Day. Will there be more than one officer who's wearing a charro?
More than likely, yes. That's what we're working on. This time, by popular demand, we're more than likely going to have both a male officer and a woman officer. There are more things that I've learned about the charro history, and one of which is that they have to demonstrate that they honor their wives. You know, with that message, we can reduce domestic violence potentially. So there are many, many benefits to communicating this and embracing our rich culture here.
That's Officer Gabriel Carvey and Police Chief Adele Freise of the Salinas Police Department in Salinas, California. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us.
The Iowa State Fair is underway, and the Democratic presidential candidates are there, along with the butter sculptures and fried foods. It is a required stop for candidates hoping to impress voters ahead of the Iowa caucuses in February. Here's Joe Biden yesterday.
We can do whatever we want to do. If we remember, we can do it together. Folks.
NPR's Scott Detrow is also there. He joins us from Des Moines. Hi, Scott.
Hey there.
So we heard Biden there. Who's turning heads at the fair so far?
Well, Biden was the first to speak, and it was really a spectacle that just underscored how much of a frontrunner Joe Biden is. Like, usually the goal at the fair is for candidates to meet caucus goers, to mingle and things like that. And Biden was just surrounded by, like, dozens and dozens of cameras and microphones and was just walking as this giant blob. And it was such a contrast. Montana Governor Steve Bullock was there as well. And he's like riding the rides with his family, just having a great day at the fair with a reporter here and there. And that just shows the difference between the person polling at 30-something percent and the person polling at 1%.
Is that style, though, what Steve Bullock was doing, is that useful to candidates to be seen as just a regular person who can get on the rides and you know, hang out with the regular people at the Iowa State Fair?
I mean, certainly you need more than that pretty soon at this point, especially with this higher bar to qualify for the debates next month, mm-hmm. where you need to be polling higher and have more donors. But I think a candidate like Steve Bullock and a lot of the other candidates fighting to get to 1-2% do have a lot to gain from the fair, and that's because there's just so many reporters there. Press from all over the world is here to hear candidates speak, to interview them, to talk to them. This is the place where people will hear your message.
Okay, so let me ask you about the most recent poll out of Iowa, which shows Biden, Warren, Sanders, Buttigieg, and Harris as the only candidates above 5% support. Is it too late now for the candidates who are around 1-2% in the polls to really be competitive? Or is this so far away from the caucuses that anything can happen?
I think it's somewhere in the middle. I've thought a lot about this. Certainly, there's the five candidates who not only are polling well, but have a ton of money and are really fundraising well. And then there's this enormous gulf. I still do think there's a lot of time for one or two other candidates to navigate that gulf, to catch on in a debate, or to really start landing with voters. I think there is a lane for maybe one or two other candidates to make their way to that top tier. I have a hard time seeing more than that number really getting to a higher point. But again, we're not sure what's going to happen over the next few months, but certainly a lot of these candidates are starting to worry about whether they're going to qualify for the debates or maybe have to end their campaign this fall.
When I was in Cincinnati last week, I spoke with some Democrats there. They were very impressed in the debate by Elizabeth Warren. What are you hearing from Democratic voters there at the state fair?
Warren is a name that comes up a lot. She has a huge staff in Iowa. She's really focused on Iowa from the beginning. Later today, I'm going to be spending a lot of time with Kamala Harris. She's someone who's been polling well, has a lot of fundraising. But up until recently, she hadn't really focused on Iowa as much as Warren and Bernie Sanders has. Harris is taking a bus ride across the state this week. A lot of candidates are doing something similar. You're starting to see campaigns realize they need to do well in Iowa. They can't just have a strategy of waiting until later primaries or caucuses.
That's NPR's political correspondent Scott Detrow in Iowa as the Iowa State Fair goes on and the candidates descend. Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks. I'll have a pork chop on a stick for you.
Good.
As a nation, much of our focus this week has been on the mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton that left 31 people dead. But a group of mothers is asking that we also not forget about another American city gripped by gun violence, Chicago. Joining us now is Tamar Manasseh, founder of Mothers and Men Against Senseless Killings in Chicago. Tamar, you're a lifelong Chicago resident, right? With two grown children.
That's correct.
Yeah, just last weekend, Chicago police say there were 60 people shot and 7 people killed. The city averages that about 7 people are shot every day in your city. First of all, Tamar, I want to offer condolences to you, because even if you didn't know all of these folks, these are mothers and fathers and children. And as someone who's trying to stop gun violence, this has to feel infuriating.
It does. And it's for the first time since I've been doing what I've been doing, and I've been doing it for 5 years, it's terrifying because out of those 7 murders that took place in Chicago over the weekend, one of them, I was literally right in the middle of the murder scene when we got word that there were 2 mass shootings. So for most Americans, it was something that they were seeing and hearing unfold on television and through media. But it's something when you're hearing and seeing it on your phone and down your timeline on Facebook, but you're literally standing feet away from where a young man is lying dead underneath the sheet on the street, and there are blue lights and sirens and emergency vehicles and red tape. So while you're hearing about this larger scene unfolding, and I think it was in El Paso at that time, you're right in the middle of seeing it happen locally. So it has a way of making you feel claustrophobic, like it's closing in on you. And I realized that being in the middle of a scene like that, that it just wasn't a Chicago problem or a mass shooting problem or a gang problem or just a suburban problem or urban problem or a city problem. It's a very American problem. Gun violence is indiscriminate.
And yet we hear very little about what's happening in Chicago. Every once in a while, we hear news stories about these shootings, but we're not having wall-to-wall coverage and having this deeper discussion that you're talking about gun violence being an American problem. You're out in the street. You are the one that's trying to stop gun violence in Chicago. Tell me a little bit about the work that you're doing there and how perhaps are you seeing a pathway to change or difference? Are you feeling helpless and afraid, as you mentioned earlier?
Well, afraid is one thing that I feel, but helpless never. There are too many people that want to end gun violence, so I can't ever really feel helpless. I feel like there we just need to work harder. I sit on the street corner every day, 7 days a week in the summer in a neighborhood called Inglewood. And we cook dinner every night and we create a safe space for the kids to come and play. And basically a place where we can build community again, where people don't have to worry about getting shot. It's a place where we try to plant seeds of hope there. This is the Chicago that we can live in versus the one outside of these gates that we do live in. And so I went there because a mom was murdered there 5 years ago, breaking up a fight between two kids in broad daylight. And the news reported it as her being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Instead of the shooters being in the wrong place at the wrong time and doing the wrong thing, it's almost like the blame was placed on the mom.
And that corner, you went there 5 years ago, and you all have been trying to build that community. And yet 2 weeks ago, two young mothers were shot and killed at that very corner.
Right.
26-year-old Chantel Grant and 35-year-old Andrea Studemeyer. What can you tell us about these young mothers?
They were good mothers. I mean, like, that's all. They were good mothers. Mm-hmm. It was nothing, I mean, remarkably different about these moms than any other moms. They were good mothers. And I think the murders of any mothers, the mothers of women, the mothers of people, period, or people in general, not just moms, when people are murdered, it deserves to get the attention that the murders of these two women got. All of the women that are murdered in this city deserve to get the same amount of attention. We're tired of being afraid. Americans are so afraid. That's why there are so many guns. We're so afraid. Just today, two of my friends, one was going to a mushroom festival in Maryland, I think. And she said she wasn't going to go because she's afraid of getting shot. This is not a black mother. She's not poor. She's not a single mom. She doesn't live in Chicago. She's not any of the things that people, you know, ignore when they hear it. I have another friend who's timing when he goes to Costco because, you know, he doesn't want to be potentially a victim of a mass shooter. And so it's kind of like, you know, this is a softer time. We're timing when we live our lives in between shootings. And that is terrifying. We're afraid. We're afraid of everything.
Tamar, you mentioned earlier race. How much does this come into play in the coverage that you all receive about what's happening, the amount of fervor that the American public feel about what's happening in Chicago, from your view?
Race plays a great deal in the conversation. But at this time, I don't think we can even afford to discuss that. Because if you white out all the names and the information on those death certificates and you just leave the cause of death, it's all going to say gunshot wounds. Doesn't matter the race. It doesn't matter the gender. It doesn't matter the location. It doesn't matter any of that. All that matters is gunshots, is gunshot wounds. And I think that's where we need to start. We need to start with the problem itself and not necessarily the causes of the problem, because that's what separates people. The argument about why these things are happening and not exactly what's happening. It's happening because it's white supremacy, or it's happening because of racism, or it's happening because of gangs, or it's happening because of poverty. All of those things are absolutely correct, but those things divide us along party lines, along color lines, along gender lines. They all do. But the one thing that we can agree on is that all of these people are dying from gunshot wounds. So first, I think we really need to talk about what the problem is, about the problem itself. And we all agree, okay, now we need to fight the guns. We need to fight gun violence. And then once we start to do that together, now we can start to tackle racism. We can start to tackle poverty. We can start tackling all of the things that causes the gun violence. We can do that. But first, we have to stop the bleeding before we can triage it. And that's what we all need to work on first.
You don't want people to feel sorry for you and the people of Chicago. You want them to duplicate your efforts. You want them to make change in their communities. What else would you like for them to do?
We've started a campaign just in the past week, and it's a hashtag Who's Next. And we want every American to understand that they can potentially be next. And if you aren't actively fighting gun violence, if you aren't involved in the fight against gun violence, then you're waiting to become its next victim. And everybody needs to understand that. If you can be killed in a synagogue, you can be killed in a church, you can be killed at Walmart, you can be killed on a street corner, you can be killed in a cell phone store, you can be killed sitting on your couch, watching television. People have to understand it's everywhere. And if we aren't all a part of fighting it, it's gonna win. And we can't let that happen. We all have to understand that this is bigger than our neighborhoods. It's bigger than our class. It's bigger than our gender. It's all of us. And soccer moms from the suburbs cannot fight the enemy alone. And neither can urban moms from neighborhoods like mine. We can't do it alone. We're both fighting the exact same enemy. We just have to learn to do it together. And that's what I'm hoping that people understand. At this point, we can't afford to, you know, let this die down and be quiet until another one happened, until there's another shooting, another mass shooting, until more moms are murdered. We can't do that, because what if I'm the next mom? What if you're the next mom?
Tamar Manassa is founder of Mothers and Men Against Senseless Killings in Chicago. Tamar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tamar's group continues to occupy that corner in Inglewood, that part of Chicago, and is also creating opportunities to help stem gun violence on the south side of the city. Tamar says she's opened a pizza place to help youth develop work experience and is building a school out of shipping containers. Along with supporting proposed legislation on background checks, Tamar also wants to see more education on gun safety and conflict resolution taught in schools as early as kindergarten.
Believe it or not, schools across the country are starting to reopen after summer vacation. Students at Olmsted Academy North in Louisville, Kentucky, return to school next week. And for one teacher, it means another year of calling parents to give them good news about their kids instead of telling them what's going wrong. Liz Schlemmer from member station WFPL reports.
Walk into Kenita Ballard's sixth grade language arts class during reading time, and her students are sprawled around the room, their noses in graphic novels, while she picks up her phone.
Hi, sir. This is Miss Ballard. I am Wayne's language arts teacher, and I just wanted to say that I know that reading and writing has been challenging for Wayne, but he's been working so hard.
As Ballard hands him the phone to talk to his dad, Wayne holds back a shy smile. The phone call is a treat, but it's not a special occasion. Ballard makes time every Friday to call her students' families with a positive message. She says it's a policy at Jefferson County Public Schools to call home when a student comes close to failing a class. But when Ballard realized she was telling parents more about their kids' problems than their successes, she decided to change things up.
As soon as I see some type of growth, some type of glimmer, some type of anything positive, I'm going to take that chance to celebrate it.
Ballard teaches language arts at Olmsted Academy North, an all-boys middle school on the south side of Louisville, Kentucky. The school serves a high-needs population. More than two-thirds of the students are economically disadvantaged. Most are Black or Brown, and many have learning disabilities. Ballard says that just means her students need more support.
It's about seeing all of those good things that the child does and setting them up for success.
Terry Scott is a professor at University of Louisville's College of Education and Human Development. He studies classroom management and positive reinforcement.
Every single time a kid is successful with anything they do in school and is told about it, statistically increases the probability of another success. So if you really want more successes, you have to build successes. It's going to take one before you can get to two. It's going to take two to get to three.
Scott and his team of researchers studied teacher-student interactions in Louisville and around the world, looking for positive and negative feedback.
The evidence for positive feedback is overwhelming.
Their research found elementary school students hear positive feedback about once every 7.5 minutes.
But it goes down, way down, by middle, and at high school, it's incredibly low. Our research shows that the average kid in a high school classroom hears more negative than positive from a teacher.
That's the average kid. Scott says negative feedback is higher for Black boys and for students with learning disabilities, for students like Ms. Ballard's.
And what you're describing is somebody doing this systematically, that I'm going to look for these kids doing it right, and I'm going to call their parents on a regular basis and let them know. And I think that's very different and distinct, and I think that's what makes this really important.
Ballard especially tries to encourage her students after they've struggled.
If I had to make a negative phone call, I'm going to find the first thing that I can do to celebrate, because that lets the child again know, hey, I'm watching you, I got your back, I see all of you.
So when her student Kamari was suspended for bad behavior in another class, the first day he came back, Ballard picked up her phone.
Hi, ma'am, this is Ms. Ballard. I know Kamari just came off of a little issue, but ma'am, I just wanted to let you know, because I was going to plan on calling yesterday, but, you know, he wasn't here. But I do want to just say, ma'am, that, you know, Kamari sometimes make bad choices, but overall, he makes really good choices. I want to celebrate that and highlight that because, ma'am, you know, he came in today, got straight to work, didn't let anything hold him back.
Ms. Ballard holds Kamari's hand while she talks to his mom.
Why do you think Ms. Ballard does this?
Because she loves us and she wants us to, like, be good and stay good and have an education so we can move on to the seventh grade.
Ballard says no one taught her to do this with students, but as a language arts teacher, using words to lift up students just made sense.
It's not about just a piece of candy. It's not about getting some type of star. It's about we are recognizing with our words what you're able to do.
And U of L Professor Terry Scott says he hopes more teachers learn her ways because research shows positivity works. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Schlemmer in Louisville.
So Tanya Mosley, our new co-host, you have a Louisville connection.
I do. I actually lived and worked there for a year. It's a beautiful part of the country, the hills and valleys. It's so green.
And have the public been? Radio station. Yes, yeah. I just broadcast from WFPL. Fantastic public radio station.
It is. It is.
Now, how was your first day co-hosting Here and Now?
We did it, Jeremy. I did it. It's the end of the show.
Another 2 hours.
And you've a got million plenty more to come. Yes.
You will hear Tanya back on the air for a full week. From August 19th. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.